Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. Today's topic, I will call it maybe today's issue, is really, really big. Let me put it to you this way. I believe today's show, and I'm having a problem trying to get this all together right now so that everybody understands what I'm talking about. I'm going to do a two-parter on today's show. Joe and Deborah, I haven't told you because it just was decided about 30 seconds ago. So that's one thing. I've been putting this show together for I don't know how long in terms of the subject matter, and like I said last week, the show last week on the purpose of education, that show really has been the subtext of almost every show we've done over the last 3.5 years, dealing with some aspect of the question, what is the purpose of education? And when I can put it in this kind of framework, this was a feature movie, 2-hour feature movie. You know by now that stories, screenplays, usually written in a 3-act structure. First act, second act, third act. The first act sets up the main issue or problem that the hero is going to have to deal with, the conflict, the players, and all that stuff. The second act is usually twice as long as the first act and the third act. Today's show is the equivalent to the second act, kicking off the second act. So that's why I decided that this is really important. I need to take my time and laying out this second act. Last week could have been a teaser. You know, when you go to the movie and you see a trailer? Well, last week was the kind of the teaser when I was asking the question of what is the purpose of education? In your view as a teacher, a parent-teacher, as a former student in public schools or even private schools, what do you view the purpose of education to be? Well, that was my teaser, and then we got into it. Today, I'm going to get into what I think is going to be several shows going into October, and maybe even longer, to fill in all the requirements that you have to do when you're telling a story in the second act. Second act is the most important part of the story. So I'm going to approach it that way. If you got our promotion this week, you know that the title of the show is Community Schools, The Last Chance for Public School Survival. There should have been a question mark there. I didn't put it in. My bad. Because I am raising a question. Is the community school, and we'll put here slash community school movement, the last chance for public school survival. What I'm referring to is this community school, and I'll try and give us a sort of generic but uniform definition, if you will, of what I'm talking about when I say community school. And today I'm going to get into the history and some of the players who sort of got us to almost to where we are today, going back with our patron saint in education, education philosophy, John Dewey. But this question of, is it the last chance, community school is the last chance for public education or public school survival? When I raise that question, the framework you already have, we're in a war on public education. That's what this whole show is about. The opposition, our opposition, wants to destroy public education. And they are doing it under the guise of a reform movement. We'll reform public education for the umpteenth time since Horace Mann got us started in this notion of public education. And that's the notion of who will survive. There have been 6 or 7 movements, education reform movements, and I've talked about this many times in the past. Those movements were to improve, to change public education, quote, make it better according to someone's vision. Vision being, in this case, purpose. This movement is different, as I said 1,000 times. This movement seeks to, not as a reform movement, changing public education from within, trying to make it better. This movement basically is to destroy public education as we've known it and create a whole different model. Right? So, there are some who say that the community school is a movement. It's akin to a reform movement. And as such, it could be the savior of public schools as we have come to know it. And what they are, those people are referring to is that if you follow or adopt the community school model and implement it correctly, and stay with it, you will see changes, a lot of changes taking place. But more importantly, you'll see the gap between white, middle class, and poor students of color begin to narrow. That's a powerful statement. There's people are saying that a good, well-conceived, implemented, maintained over a reasonable period of time can have a positive impact on, quote, those factors that the current efforts to take over public schools are supposedly based upon. Test scores, what I'm talking about. Graduation rates, what I'm talking about. Narrowing the gap, the achievement gap. That's the big one. It's a fallacious as hell, but that's the big one. The school's purpose and responsibility is to narrow the achievement gap between rich and poor. I'm calling middle class now in this example the rich and the poor, the black, the white, the brown. when we all know that that gap is there as a result of historical, social, political, economic forces that were designed to shape the life choices, opportunities, chances of everyone in this country. And that the deficit, quote, and the achievement gap is both designed slash deliberate and predictable or expected. And so when you have these reform movements, and particularly the current one, the whole idea is to narrow that gap and, if possible, eliminate it. When you know and I know that ain't gonna happen. When Lyndon Johnson, following Kennedy's lead and the war on poverty, that was a real shot if it was funded properly, if it was implemented correctly, and if it was sustained over a long period of time, would have done probably the most since the close of the Civil War to bring about some notion of equity across the board, political, economic, social, you name it. And I've mentioned before, is that short period after the Revolution, the Reconstruction period, was perhaps the most liberal, progressive 12 to 20 year in this country's history. Johnson, Kennedy Johnson, Roosevelt in the middle in there, but Kennedy Johnson approached the war on poverty would have, in my view, equal and succeeded, exceeded, I should say, far beyond those limited gains that were won after the Civil War. So, to say that community schools are looked upon as, quote, the new savior model is what I'm referring to here when I raise that question of, is it the last chance for public school survival? Now, you have to know or have some idea what a community school is. And I got some messages after we put out our show announcement Thursday that we're going to do the show on community schools. I got some questions in terms of what's a community school? Are you going to do the history of community schools? There's a community school in our community or my community there. And yes, just from the very beginning, and you know this to be true, I almost always do the historical perspective first. That's my style. And I'm the guy who always said to you that, remember Edmund Burke, he who doesn't know history is doomed to repeat it. Okay, so I always go with the historical model in any of the discussions that I'm going to present to you. So, now, let me go a little further and say that the presentation I'm going to do this week and next week picks up the notion of a community school around 1885, 84, coming for going forward. And as I've said previously, there have been variations of this notion of community schools for damn near ever. And I've talked about the slaves who would steal reading material, writing material, go back to their slave quarters, and dead of night sneak out of their quarters into the woods and light a fire to try and be able to see the print and be able to mimic the writing and et cetera. So that was, to me, a community school in its very generic form. So, but we're going to pick it up from John Dewey. Now, I'm assuming to some extent that, as I've said before, most of our audience here are either teachers, parents, teachers and who are also parents, but most, the vast majority, I'm going to say, we attended public schools mostly for our education. So that's the commonality, that's the bond, if you want to put it that way, that we share here, is that we are either, you know, teachers in public schools, parents who have kids in public schools, but we most likely all went to public schools ourselves. And in my description, I talked about the question of today, or actually starting with yesterday, today, and tomorrow, or tomorrow being the future of public education, public schools. And that what we're talking about today cuts across that continuum of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Now, also, what I said in our promo, I raised a question again. One of the questions that I raised was, what kind of teacher, 21st century teacher, can thrive in a community school? I thought that was a pretty good question. And I think you'll be surprised, maybe not, if we really get into that subject. Then I raised the question of, what are the strengths and the weaknesses of community schools? We'll get into that. And then how will students, teachers, parents in the community, school districts, use or misuse and community schools? Because they're, and again, I hope I'll be able to get through this next week in terms of the various models of the community schools, and you'll see that they have different purposes, and that's why I started off by reminding you about last week's show when we dealt with purpose. That was pretty much everything that show was all about. Now, I know that there are some people, teachers, hate Dewey. Don't understand that, but they hate Dewey. And maybe after, you know, today's conversation, you may see Dewey in a different light. Okay. Starting with Dewey. Dewey graduated from the University of Michigan back in the 1880s. Graduated in philosophy. Nothing to do with education. Zero, not a zip. His focus was a particular subset of philosophy, Hegelian philosophy, raising the question of democracy. What is democracy? How does it come into existence? How does it function? Is it real democracy? All those questions, you know, philosophical questions pertaining to education. And so he gets an appointment at Chicago, University of Chicago. University of Chicago was brand new. They were just, you know, finishing the physical structure to some extent, creating schools or divisions and all. And Dewey got a job to come in and work in a new department on pedagogy. I don't understand that word. Every time I say it, I crack myself up. But anyway, that was about the closest he would come to education, was pedagogy. He didn't train in this area, but he comes to Chicago and he becomes a professor of pedagogy. Fortunately for Dewey, and I'm going to say for us, the president of this new school was a progressive. And he had some very pronounced progressive ideas about how he wanted the University of Chicago to go about providing education. And he enabled Dewey to be able to work in that area, again, purpose of creating an education school, education department, and all. And hence, Monsieur Dewey moves from all-out heavy philosophy to get into education. And we know him for his contributions to this area that is known as philosophy of education, or education philosophy. In graduate school, be it the master's or PhD, there are courses dealing with philosophy in education. What is the philosophy of education? What is the philosophy behind education, schooling, and et cetera? So Dewey makes this transition, and I'm going to call it a transition, into this area. And he becomes the person who is what is influenced by the president of University of Chicago. But he's, while there, he's only there 10 years, he comes in contact with two, I'll call them scholars for now, very influential people, Jane Addams in Chicago, and you may know her or her name associated with Hull House, and I'll talk about that in a minute, and the father of psychology in Germany, Wilhelm Wundt. Wilhelm Wundt, and I'll start with him. He developed theories and then methodologies for making this new field that called psychology a scientific discipline. Operative word here is scientific. Collecting data, analyzing data, the relationship between the findings of the data and theoretical propositions. That's science in a nutshell. Before, academic study was basically always philosophy. Then this thing called science, the scientific method, comes in, and the social sciences, sociology, psychology, to get started, are all trying to become respected and accepted scientific disciplines. Wilhelm Wundt was the father of scientific psychology. Dewey was overwhelmingly impressed with this notion of scientific psychology, scientific period. I'm giving you a very, very short condensed version here, in that he would take the scientific method, the scientificism that he saw Wilhelm using, and would shape, and you know this, I'm sure, the Chicago Laboratory School around Wilhelm's scientific approach to psychology. Let me say that again, in case I didn't get it out there correctly. The University of Chicago Lab School is considered one of the best schools anywhere in the world. It has, for decades after decades after decades, turned out some of the best prepared, best and brightest students from now pre-K to 12th grade that you will find anywhere in the country. And I mentioned in the past, as a side note here, that in my junior year at Whittier College, I met and got to know three seniors who were graduates of Chicago Lab School. And I'm going to tell you, I was impressed. I thought I was good. These three people, they were awesome. In first year graduate school, I met two more graduates. They were undergrad. They were like juniors. One was a junior and one was a graduate student. A senior and then a graduate student who were University of Chicago Laboratory School graduates. Phenomenal these people were. So that lab school was basically what the name says, a laboratory where experimental approaches to education would be designed, conducted. And in the process, the students would learn a certain kind of curriculum that went hand in hand with this scientific approach to learning, hence education. Now, again, let me just jump ahead for a moment. Today, education, everywhere you look, this notion of experiential education, what Dewey talked about in terms of you learn best when you hands-on. And when he talked about children growing up on farms, and they had to learn how to become farmers, how to survive, using their hands, actually getting experience, and that was the best form of learning. That's with us today. That's all the rage today, when inquiry approach and investigative approach to education, raising an issue and then researching the issue. Teachers, you know what I'm talking about, because I'm sure you guys are being bombarded with this as the new and best way to educate students is through experience. Well, that was Dewey, by the way, folks. And he implemented that model at the University of Chicago. A second influence on Dewey, as I said, was Jane Addams and Hull House. Hull House was like a community center in Chicago, in the urban blighted areas of Chicago. And it catered to mostly the new immigrants coming to the United States from Europe. Again, back to history, in the period of the 1880s, 1890s, 1880s, 1890s, into the 1900s, the 10s, the 20s, and 30s, there was this huge influx of immigrants coming from Europe, settling in through the urban centers, New York, Chicago, other areas. And what Jane Addams saw was the poverty, of course, and the need for providing social services to this new immigrant population. Scott at Hull House. She got that idea from studying in Europe. They had such institutions that catered to the very, very poor, providing services, social services, health services. She brought that idea back. She started Hull House. The president of University of Chicago, he knows about this. He encourages Dewey to become familiar with this. Dewey meets Jane Addams. He studies Hull House, and he's expected to turn the lab school basically into what the present day we call community school. He was expected to. never happen. But here, I'm now laying the first germs of the notion of a community school and associating Dewey with it. This would become a really big thing, folks. The notion here was that the purpose of education, public education, was conceived of and being more than just teaching people their ABCs, their numbers, and how to write, and socializing people to get skills and values that when they leave the school system, they would go out and occupy, quote, their proper role in society. And most we're talking about here, the poor, would get this education, and they would come out and be able to fulfill the duties, the requirements of their role as a member of either the very poor or the working class. That was the purpose of education back then. And now, and I guess I'm giving you a little head start here, by thinking of the schools in terms of what Dewey learned from Jane Addams, that's a change in purpose. I'm just going to lay it out there, and I'll back that up in a few minutes. But we're now talking about a change of purpose here of the school. Moving from when we didn't have mandatory public schools requirement where you had to send your kid to school, thanks to Horace Mann, not the mandatory part, but the public school, erection of public schools in all states and communities, and then the mandatory requirement of sending your kids to school. The purpose there, especially in urban centers, was to take all these immigrants and the poor coming up from the South, the great black migration after the Civil War, and the World War I, which was coming, and these people, giving them an education, an education whose purpose was to allow them to fulfill various roles that were needed to maintain the status quo of that time. I've said this a million times, maybe this time a little differently. So that's what we have. When we move forward, keep in mind how the change of the model is driven by a different purpose. And every time we seek to change the model, you have to ask yourself, why? The purpose. Why equal purpose in this example? Okay. As I said, Dewey was at the University of Chicago for 10 years. President Harper wanted Dewey to chair this new department called pedagogy. In getting ready to do this, Dewey relied upon someone else we know quite a bit, Plato. Remember, Plato is considered almost the founder of civilized knowledge. I don't agree with that, but that's his status in life or society. Plato and the Republic. Dewey and has his notion now of the philosophy of education. Plato had a worldview. He was an aristocrat, and like our stereotypic image of philosophers, he was very contemplative. Dewey, on the other hand, was a Democrat and an activist. But he admired Plato immensely. And what he got, even though they differed in terms of philosophical perspectives, the one thing that he really admired after he got to Chicago and got involved with this Department of Pedagogy, Jane Addams, and President Harper of Chicago, he admired Plato for laying out the relationship between education and society. That these two were interrelated. These two influenced each other. Very few people had talked about the relationship. What today we use the term intersectionality, the intersecting of education and society. For Dewey, his notes developing this philosophy of education, he was coming to the conclusion that the most important area of the study of philosophy was this thing called social philosophy. Social philosophy, all of social philosophy at its core, was philosophy of education. Let me go back and break that down. If you remember, if you took a philosophy class in undergraduate school, if you took graduate courses in education, you most likely came in contact with two courses, the history of education and the philosophy of education. And it's the philosophy of education that is the foundation of our whole approach to schooling, be it public school, private school, and to teaching. This was huge to say that, first of all, philosophy being the first discipline, academic discipline, 2,000 years or more foundation, Plato, Socrates, you name it, all the great, quote, we call them great now, philosophers coming out of Greece and Rome and other parts of Europe as time would go by, to reduce all of philosophy down to philosophy of education was huge. But that was necessary for Dewey to make the connection between society and education, education and society. We've talked about this many, many times here, that the purpose of education and for schools, let's go purpose of education for public schools or all schools, is to be agents of socialization. The responsibility for turning every student into a particular kind of young adult to be able to function within the structure of a given society. That is huge, and that's where Dewey contribution comes to us in stone almost, and it is the almost, I want to say right now, the foundation of where we're heading in terms of community schools. So let me add something to Dewey, getting from Plato, the relationship between education and society, and then when it comes down to it, all philosophy is philosophy of education. What I haven't said was that when Dewey was studying philosophy, getting his doctorate, when Dewey came out of school with his doctorate in philosophy, Dewey had a dream. It's called Dewey's Dream. And that dream was for a universal participatory democratic society. That he thought that every society on the planet should become a participatory democratic society. We certainly deal with that issue today, participatory democracy. And the election we just had and the manipulation potentially of the electorate, and then all the back in the slavery when women couldn't vote, thus they couldn't participate in, quote, this new democracy. Slaves, of course, were not human, so they couldn't vote. This notion of participatory democracy, that was Dewey's dream, that he set out, he wanted to, like me and my better world philosophy, he had his dream of participatory democratic society and how he could help bring about these societies, beginning with America. The lab school was supposed to be this laboratory that would allow him to take his philosophical ideas and turn them into action. That it never happened, but that was another tie that between Dewey and where we are today in terms of the school, the role of schools, the purpose of schools, and what they could be, should be. And when Dewey was trying to push this notion of participatory democratic societies, he then looked at schooling itself. And he called it participatory democratic schooling. And he said that we needed, I mean, I'll say we like I'm adding myself in and you into all of this, but America needed this democratic schooling systems that we call districts now, state departments of education, districts, individual schools, community schools, neighborhood schools. They should be all based upon, both in theory and practice, curriculum, years of schooling, should all be based upon this notion of participatory democratic schooling. Is that sort of like where we are today? This was back in the late 1800s, getting into the early 1900s. So that we see now the foundation being laid here for this notion of community schools. With Dewey, while still in Chicago, and still having association with Jane Addams, he was starting to get this notion of how can I push the envelope towards trying to make America and other countries this model of participatory democracy. And then he made the connection. Remember I said the connection between education and schools. He wrote what many today experts, non-experts, call the most important essay almost ever on education in schools. His essay was on the school as a social center. That was a drum roll, folks. The school as a social center. We will see later and next week that community schools, I'm going to jump ahead and just give you this, community schools are visions of community schools that they are anchors, anchor institutions of their society, of their community. That the school becomes the important anchor of the community's life, its growth and development, and that everything of importance basically come in or goes out from what we mostly call neighborhood school now, but community schools. I'm going to deviate for a moment here. This is what we'll be talking about almost forever here. The school as an anchor institution. Almost everyone I'm talking to now goes to shopping malls. I don't care where you live. You go to the big shopping mall. When the shopping malls were built, I think the first one was built in Culver City area of Los Angeles. You got this huge, huge, huge structure. You're going to have, hopefully, millions of people coming in. How are you going to get them to come in? How are you going to get them to come there as opposed to continuing going to the little neighborhood stores, shopping through catalogs and what have you? The developers came up with this notion of anchor clients. And you know, when you go into the mall, on the far end of each mall, back in the 80s and 90s, 2000s, even the 70s when the malls were coming up, you would have a really big name store. In many cases, it would be Sears, JCPenney. These were the anchor clients. And then all of the little shops there could benefit from JCPenney, Sears, their advertising, their huge budgets, and the shopping malls became the center of commerce. And you get that? I mean, you already know that? It is the big name stores that bring people, and their advertising that brings people to the malls. And then the little stores are able to hopefully sell their merchandise to a much larger population than they ever would be able to do if the malls didn't have these big, huge clients bringing people in by the tens of thousands. Now you have a Target. You have, I don't do a lot of shopping, folks, so you have to help me here with what's the big name stores now that you'll find in these big, gigantic malls. Those shopping centers become the center of commerce, but they also become the center of a lot of social activity. You have movie theaters in them now. You have things that food, eatery places that brings people in, and you hopefully see what I'm saying, that the school is that plays that function. And it has. I talk quite a bit about the fact that when I was growing up, our schools was the anchor institution in our neighborhood. Many of the teachers lived in the neighborhood, or definitely in the city. And they would come to the schools, they got to know the community. More importantly, they got to know the students in their class so that they could tell, this is going to be a bad day for Jimmy because he's, you know, showing all the signs, or this is going to be a good day for Margaret. She's so long, but she got to know the student. There was a relationship that was built up in that classroom, in that school, in that community. The parents got to know the teachers. And I've said several times, there are teachers that I had at my school who their kids were my classmates. They may have taught at another school, but they knew the kids in the community. They knew the parents, even though they weren't teaching there. The school was the hub. I keep saying and repeating because this is the crux of everything that we're talking about. Now, Dewey saw this, and he said the schools would become the instrument that would help create, maintain this participatory democratic society. He made that connection. It was fabulous at the time. But there was a problem. He would talk quite a bit about this, but he never was able to work it out, going from theory to practice. Of course, he didn't teach in the grades. He was at the university. And he sort of like fell out of favor at Chicago. And then he moved from Chicago to Columbia. And his work in education suffered as a result of it. But he gave us the theoretical, philosophical foundation for what schools could be. They weren't at the time, but he was saying this is what they could be in the future. And then there would be universities, University of Pennsylvania and Philadelphia would jump on this idea. The University in Kentucky would jump on this idea. And we will see next week what the growth of this notion of the community schools. And I'll tell you now that today there are a variety of community school concepts and practices. And they have some similar, but also some very different purposes for what they're doing. And I'll try and point that out. I'll tell you one right now that gets my interest all the time, and that is the notion that there's full-service community schools. There are communities and schools. There are the full-service schools, 21st century community schools. Then your basic generic community schools. But they have similar services, as I said, but they also have different services. And the bottom line here is that the notion of service, the services they provide, and why they provide A service and not B service, or why they provide A, B, and C service and not X, Y, Z service. That will be our talk for next week, and I'll continue to try and relate purpose to the various models and then try and answer the questions that I raised at the beginning of the show, and especially the question of who benefits from community schools. Who benefits? All of this, everything, you have to ask the question, and whose interest is this legislation? Whose interest is this budget? Whose interest is this curriculum? Whose interest is it to have a community school? And I'll try and get to that other question in terms of the teachers we have today. Are they the best for the community schools of today and tomorrow? I phrase it more or less in the notion of what kind of teachers the 21st century will need to be able to have our kids thrive or survive and thrive in our school systems, and especially if our school systems become basically community schools. My time is up. I hope I got us off on a good footing. A lot of what I'm talked about today is philosophical, conceptual, but I believe that it was necessary in order to be able to talk more intelligently next week about what is a community school, what are the features of a community school. I'll say this, here in Buffalo, they started their community schools last year with 10 community schools. They added one for this year. But there have been places where community schools have been in existence for 10, 20 years or more. That's it. And have a good rest of this Sunday. And I'll see you next week. Thanks, everyone.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.